We're going to continue on. So this will be the fourth part of Satan the Devil, going over and understanding exactly who Satan is, what, how he began, where he began, kind of his downfall. We've gone through his character, his personality. We've talked about some of the names that he's called in the Bible. And we're down to the last two, which is we're going to start with the rewards of Satan. Kind of ends up, I told you I didn't want to finish this with just going over who he is and what he's been doing and where he's trying to take us. But I also want to show his outcome, where he ends up. Because as we look through Scripture, sometimes people get confused because it can be a little tricky with how we have to piece the Scriptures together to understand what the outcome of Satan is and what the punishment really is that falls down to him, because there's two different interpretations as to a piece that we find in Ezekiel chapter 28. You can go ahead and head over there. This is where we get some of our information as far as the fate of Satan. But this is something that we need to know and understand as far as talking about who he is and why it's important for us to stick to God's plan. So this is Ezekiel 28. This should look familiar with you because this is the reference back to the king of Tyre. It was the story that we see that could potentially be a real king that existed on the earth, but also ends up kind of being a symbol of Satan, a symbol of who he is and what he's doing. And so we looked at this and we read through this, but there's a piece in here I want to highlight now as we talk about what the outcome of Satan is and what he's doing in this world, and where this takes him. And so this is Ezekiel chapter 28. If you look at verse 16 with me. In verse 16, it says, "And by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within." So again, this is going back. Remember, this is laying out kind of his downfall. It says, "You were filled with violence within, and you sinned. And therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones." So when we look at this, this is one of the classic verses that we understand that God cast him out of his role, cast him out of the mountain of God, away from him. And he says, "I destroyed you." Now this is the part I want to look at a little bit, because what does that mean? Because if he says, "I destroyed you there," then that means he doesn't exist anymore. This is where we have to look at the word and we have to understand a little bit about the Bible and the way that sometimes it's interpreted and translated from Greek or Hebrew to English and other languages. So when we look at this, remember one of the things we talked about was Lucifer is a created being. He was created. He hasn't always existed. He's part of that angelic order that was created. We don't know the number. We don't know the size, how many there are, but we know that they were created. And so what I have up here on the screen for you are a couple different versions, a couple of the other translations that I want to read through. The first one's the New American Bible. It says, "Then I banned you from the mountain of God. The cherub drove you from among the fiery stones." And then the New International Version says, "So I drove you in disgrace from the Mount of God, and I expelled you." And then the last one is the Revised Standard Version. It says, "I cast you as a profane thing from the Mountain of God, and the guardian cherub drove you out." So when we start looking at a couple of these different translations, which end up being slightly different than the King James Version and New King James Version, this destruction that happens, this isn't a wiping him out. This isn't that Satan no longer exists, that he's no longer a thing, a being. This is talking about his position. This is talking about his role. This is talking about his ability to be there with God and fulfill what he was designed to be. So when we look at this, this is the word that is used there. This word is abad, A-B-A-D. It is a root word that can mean to wander away, to lose oneself. It can mean at different times to destroy, to perish, undo, lose, or to fail. And so I have a couple other uses that we see in the Bible. Exodus 10:7, Numbers 17:19, Job 11:20. Egypt is destroyed. Thou art undone. They shall not escape. Refuge failed me. Her hope was lost. All of these are that same word, abad. It uses that same terminology. I'm only going to focus on one of these to get the point across. And it's the very first one. It's that Exodus 10:7. When you think about what God did with Egypt and freeing the Israelites, what did he do to Egypt? What was this path that he took? Because when we think about this, Egypt was at the height of their power. They were dominating in that area. And what God did is he freed his people, but he didn't level the nation. He didn't completely destroy Egypt. Egypt continues to live throughout history. Even after the Israelites flee, God protects his people. Egypt still exists. It's still a country. It ends up being built back up to some degree as a minor power. We see them around with the Babylonians, the Assyrians. And eventually they're overtaken by the Babylon. And then subsequently they are taken over by Persia. But the nation still exists. The nation still exists today. Thousands of years later, Egypt is still there. They weren't wiped off the face of the planet. They weren't demolished. It wasn't like Jericho and the city was just crumbled and then built stuff on top of it. Egypt still exists. They're there today, and it's a recognition that what it was their power, their influence. What they held, they no longer had. That's what was destroyed. So this meaning, when we apply it to Satan, does not mean that he's poof, gone. That Satan destroyed, or that God destroyed him, and he no longer exists. This is talking about his influence, his role, the power that he held. Now he still held some power to some degree. We walked through that, didn't we? Over these last couple of sermons, we've shown how much power he still has. The prince of the power of the air. He's still the king of this world. And we see it in the society around us. We see it in the nature of human beings, of what's taking place, not only in the United States, but around the globe. He still has some power, but there's always a limit to that power. God always puts a stamp on it and says, yeah, you only have so much up to here. You can't cross this line. Thankfully, we have the entire story, and we know there's a point where God's going to take all of it away. He's going to be completely removed. And so this kind of helps us to understand that this destruction that he saw at this time, of when he sinned, remember that first sin that took place, it was before humanity was ever created. It says that Satan sinned. And so we know sin predates us as creatures. Before we were created, there was this recognition that God had laws, he had standards, he had expectations, and Lucifer stepped over that. And it says he sinned, and he was destroyed. He was removed from the position that God had put him in, along with all the other angelic beings that decided to turn away and rebel. Head over to Luke chapter 20 and verse 35. This is Luke chapter 20 and verse 35. You know, when we're looking to seek and to find Satan's fate and what happens to the angels here, it's important to get some of these relevant passages that kind of link together. They help to tell the entire story. So many pieces of what we understand today, it is because we use the beginning of the Bible, we use the middle of the Bible, and we use the end of the Bible. And we see this, we find a consistency between them. We try to get the full picture and full understanding. We don't chunk it up and say, well, only this applies now, only this applies later, only this applies at all. We have to use the entire Bible because God's very consistent in what he's doing. Now, Christ here is making a statement about marriage, but it applies and helps us to understand kind of what's going on with Satan. This is Luke chapter 20. If you look at verses 35 and 36, here it says, "But those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage." And then verse 36, "Nor can they die anymore." This is talking about human beings that are changed into spirit. Once that conversion takes place, we know to be part of the family of God, we can't be flesh and blood. We can't be what we are today standing here. So it says that this is talking about the human beings are changed. It says, "Nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." So this reference, he's talking about marriage here, but he's teaching us something about a spirit being, what the spirit realm is. He goes, there's not going to be any more death. We're going to be like the angels from that standpoint. So in this case, there's an equality in terms of spirit life as what the angels are. Now, unfortunately, a lot of Christianity teaches that we will be angels. You've seen all the pictures of angels playing harps before the throne of God. And that's the outcome of what humanity is, that we're just trying to become angels. That downplays the true story that God has in store for us. That downplays what God is doing with us. It's a shame, because if what God is doing with us is such a greater thing than that, than being an angel. It's part of His family. It's to be part of His family, one of His children. It says we are to become sons and daughters. And so to say we're just supposed to be part of this other created angelic realm, it's really a shame if that is what we think we're trying to attain. Because it's a lot more significant as to what God's doing with us if we realize He wants us as His family. He wants us as His children. So when we think about the resurrection, we are all working towards that point. A resurrection of either from death to life and a change, or it says there will be some still alive at the time of Christ's return who will just be changed. We are going to enter into immortality. We have to be careful, because there's a difference between immortality and eternity. Immortality, you have a beginning, but you don't have an end. There is no end. Eternity is you don't have a beginning and you don't have an end. Right now there's only two beings that have that. It's Jesus Christ, who was the Word, and God the Father. They have no beginning, they have no end. They have always existed, they will always exist. They're bringing us into that family that will always exist. But we do have a beginning. So we are working towards immortality, which is the same thing that the angels have, because they are a created order. The angelic realm was created. Remember John 1:1, we went through that, where it talks about, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and through the Word, all things were created. Paraphrasing, all things were created through the Word. Even that angelic order. So we have to remember that Satan is part of that. He does have a beginning. He does have a beginning. And this reference tells us that there is no death after this. And so what does that mean for Satan? Because that's part of the hope that we rely on. When we think about joining God's family, is that there is no end. We are immortal. We will last forever. When we look at the Day of Atonement with the two goats, it helps us to fully understand exactly what is going to take place, what the plan is for Satan, how God works this out. You can go ahead and head back to Leviticus chapter 16. This is Leviticus chapter 16. We're not going to read a ton of this in here, but I want to read a couple of clips of this. Because this is where we really start to understand this immortality and what happens with Satan. So the first section I want to look at, it's going to be verse 7. So This pictures a sacrifice, which this is that confusing part that I told you about, that people have two different ideologies. There's a frame of mind that think both of these goats represent Jesus Christ. But it doesn't make a lot of sense when we really look at what they are, when we look at how it's lined out. Because what did Jesus Christ do? He laid down his life. He was the sacrifice. One of these goats becomes a sacrifice. The second one is let go into the wilderness. I say let go. He's not really let go. He's kind of more cast out, which is going to really align with the way God is working with Satan. So look at verse 7 and read with me all the way down through, we'll look at verse 10. It says, "He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat or Azazel. Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell, offered as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and to let it go as the scapegoat into the wilderness." So one of these is clearly going to be a sin offering. A sin offering. Jesus Christ was the sin offering. It's why we don't make sacrifices anymore. Actually, funny story, this complete sidetrack, but Ketuvik this year, just a couple weeks ago, I was sitting down with the director of Ketuvik that owns the facility over there, and we were having a discussion. Every year, they ask a couple questions about what we believe, the way we run our camps. We have a really good relationship. We can joke and laugh. He's got a whole bunch of new staff this year. So generally, they have anywhere from 2 to 10 employees that work. They run all of the high ropes courses for us. They run the climbing wall. They have lifeguards. So they have to have a decent little staff. Now it's a lot easier than what they normally do. Normally they're babysitting 24/7 when they have camps come in where we go, no, we want to run our camp. And they love it because they get a whole bunch of extra time off. So this year I was sitting in Scott's office and we were talking. He goes, yeah, I was talking with the new guys about what you guys do and what you believe. And they had a lot of questions. And so we were talking back and forth because we've had good conversations over the years. He goes, yeah, I was really messing with them this year because we were talking about the Jewish things that the Jews do and that you're not really Jewish. And all of a sudden they go, wait, like on Thursday, are they going to bring a goat in to sacrifice for the Sabbath? And Scott goes, and I told him, yeah, expect to see a goat come in. He goes, that goat they'll be sacrificing on the Sabbath morning. And so I was very, very tempted to buy a goat just to bring it into camp, just to have some fun. I got sidetracked all week long and didn't have the chance to do that. But it was on my to-do list that was going to be some Camp Ketuvik funds this year to buy a goat. And then when the home office goes, you bought a goat? I'd go, don't worry. Don't even ask. It was well worth it. So these I told you it was a little sidetrack. Has to do with goats, and sacrifices. Couldn't let that funny story go though. And so we had these two goats. One of them is that sin offering, right? Jesus Christ, the ultimate penalty for sin. We don't make sacrifices. See, that's kind of where we start, right? We don't make sacrifices anymore. Because the ultimate sacrifice has already been paid. Jesus Christ's blood was spilled for all of humanity that has ever existed, that exists today, and will ever exist in the future. So there's no reason for this anymore. But at this point, that hadn't taken place. And so they were still going through the ceremonial, the ritual system that they had with the Levitical priesthood. And so when we talk about this one sacrifice, God selected it, right? They cast lots. So God picked which one was going to be his sacrifice. He's still always in control. And so when we look at the second goat of what it is of being let go and released into the wilderness, we come to the conclusion, you know, it's the church's stance, it's our belief, and we've concluded that we're not going to destroy Satan. That's not what God is going to do. We just read about how we will have immortality, that there will be no more death once we become children of God, spiritual children of God, and have this change. It tells us we're going to be like this angelic realm, that they won't die. And so we come to this conclusion that Satan's not going to be destroyed. And we link back to this ceremonial system that God used to show that this other one is released. Now, if you drop down just a little bit, I want to read another section here. So this takes place, the next couple of sections talks about the sacrifice being made. So a bull has to first be sacrificed to purify the priest before he can even do his sacrifice, right? He has to be clean. He has to be pure just to do the sacrifice to God in the first place of the goat. But the goat sacrificed that penalty of sin. And this is why people get confused, because it uses this word atoning and talking about sin, that this second goat being cast away as this atonement for sin. But if you think about it, the atoning part has already taken place. That first goat was the whole purpose of atoning for those sacrifices. So when we read this second one, look at verse 20 now. It says in verse 20, it says, "And when he has made an end of the atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. Aaron shall lay both hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel, and all of their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, then, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. The goat shall bear on itself all the iniquities of an uninhabited land and shall release the goat into the wilderness." This goat is sent off, it sounds like, into a destitute area. No more interactions, no help, no support, no influence. When we look through the nature of Satan, what he is craving, why he's fighting so hard. Remember, it all went back to what? Pride. But pride led him to wanting to be worshipped. His whole goal is to be worshipped. And when you're isolated and all alone, there is nobody to worship you. There's nobody to even beg or influence to try to worship you. And so this is him being released into outer darkness. And we don't know what exactly that means. Our human brain can't really comprehend that yet. We can't fathom this outer darkness. Now, with the more and more technology that we have and understanding the universes and what that means with the telescopes that we have now, it's amazing that we just continue to see more and more and more space. More things out there that have been created. But Satan in the future, this is kind of like a two-fold step process. Number one, Satan's going to be locked away where he can't influence humanity anymore. Right? During the millennial process, Satan's going to be locked away so that for 1,000 years, humanity can grow and develop and learn God's laws and rules and have a relationship with him and only fight human nature. No demonic influences, no other thoughts, no other obstacles other than our own pride, our own stupidity. That's what it ends up being a lot of times. But that's what we have to fight. And that's what they get to do for 1,000 years. Step one. Step two is he is removed from having any interaction with anybody. With the family of God, he is expelled for good. It says, into an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat into the wilderness. That's step two of this plan that God has. He's not the sacrifice. When we think about sinning, that first goat had just been sacrificed for all the sins of Israel when all of this was made. So this whole next process is that there is some blame on Satan. There is some blame for what happens in the world today. Him as the leader, as the king, as whatever he wants to be called, all those different names. There's a penalty on him. Because he did have an influence on Eve and the decisions that she made. He had an influence on Adam, and he has had an influence on us. And the times that we slip and we fall and we make mistakes, he has part to play in that. And so this isn't him being a sacrifice. This is God going, now it's time for you to own up to what you've caused, what you've created. And so when it goes through and says, he put their transgressions concerning all the sins, putting them on the head of the goat and sending it away into the wilderness by the hands of a suitable man. This isn't him being a sacrifice, because the sacrifice gets slaughtered. The blood has to be shed. That's the penalty. Death is the penalty for sin. And Jesus Christ is the ultimate penalty of that first goat. This one is God going, you have zero influence going forward. No longer will you be able to impact my family. Which is a really cool feeling. Head over to 2 Peter chapter 2 with me. 2 Peter chapter 2. Humanity has come up with lots of stories and ideas and ideologies that don't align biblically. And so when we look at 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4, we start to get to see a little bit of this. It says, for if God not spare the angels who sinned, so these are the angels that rejected God. They're the ones that rebelled against him and took Satan's side. It says, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. There's this holding place. This word hell here. The Greek word is Tartaru. Tartaru. Now this word is only used this one time in the New Testament. This is the only place that this pops up, this word Tartaru for hell. And it's indicating this place of restraint. When we think about what we read earlier, with Satan was cast out of the mountain of God. He was no longer in his role. He was sent to a place of holdings to some degree, right? He has a little bit of mobility. He has flexibility in where he's able to go on the earth and what he's able to do. But it seems like to some degree there are constraints. There's a refinement that he has, indicating this restraint. Got my rubber duckies. We're okay. In classical Greek mythology, they use this in literature oftentimes to portray the underworld. The underworld in Greek mythology was this place of torture and torment. It was a place of restraint where wicked people would be confined to. And they were tormented day and night for eternity. That's where I say, as humanity, we come up with these ideologies and we come up with these different things that we think make sense. But in the long term, we don't find it as part of biblical scripture. We don't find it as part of God's plan. So this idea that God is going to torture us as human beings forever and ever doesn't align with what his word says. It doesn't even align with what it says is going to happen to Satan. Because what it says is he is cast out. He is led out into the wilderness to be alone. To be alone. Not that he's going to be chained up and tortured. Whatever goes along with the torture. Don't know what it is. But he's not going to be tormented forever. Now there's a punishment that happens to him because of the decisions that he has made. It's an eternal one. But it's not a torture. Because the problem with that is it never tells us that scripturally. Never once. For humanity, the ones who reject Satan are destroyed. They're burned up. thrown into the lake of fire, and then the entire earth is destroyed. Nowhere does it ever talk about torture or torment for eternity. These are man-made things. That might be part of what Satan's plan is. Satan may have helped influence us just to detract from God's plan, his whole purpose of what he's doing, where he's taking us, how he works. You don't have to turn to either one of these. These are just two quick references that I wanted to read for you. Of how this plays out. Matthew 25, verse 41, it says, "Then he will also say to those on the left hand, 'Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels.'" We know that they are ended up cast out there. This is what we're about to read here in Revelation chapter 20. This is the other piece that we find there. This is Revelation 20, verse 10. This is New King James Version. It says, "And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are," or a better translation of that would be, oh, I didn't put it up on the slide, "were cast." Oh, there it is. There, you can see the little side note there. Were cast. Because as human beings, remember, the beast and the false prophet are both going to be human beings. They have power, but this fire is going to burn them up. They're no longer there. There's nothing left of them. And then it says, this is where Satan is going to be cast. This is where the devil ends up. It says, "The beast and the false prophet are or were cast and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever." And we just read through that. I wanted to preface this with that understanding of this wilderness. Not a torture, not a put him into some weird contraption and stretch him and pull him and burn him, whatever all devices we've seen through medieval times. If you want nightmares, look at medieval torture devices. Couldn't imagine going through some of the things that they did to people. It is grotesque. That's all there is to it. That's not what this is. Remember that isolation for Satan. When his whole goal is to be worshipped, to have people focus on him, to be praised, to be sat up into the position of God, when there is nobody left to do that, that's got to be torture. If that's his whole frame of mind, his whole purpose, that is torture on a whole nother level. That goes into that psychological or mental warfare and what that does to people. But the spirit realm isn't going to be consumed on the same level as the physical. And we just know that. Head over to Jude. If you look at Jude, I've got one final reference for this section. When we start putting all of this together, that's why I said we use the Bible together. The whole package, the whole deal. We go to Old Testament, we go to New Testament. We look at different pieces to understand how God's plan works to the best that we can. I told you I don't have all the answers for everything and how it works out, because he just hasn't given us some of the information. But he's given us enough to know that we don't want to be on that path. That's what he always does. He gives us enough to know what we need to do to be part of his family. And there's other things he goes, it's not that important. Leave it alone. And we go, yeah, but it's really interesting. And he's going, yeah, just leave it alone. And sometimes we dip our toe in the water and we fall down a hole, right? Curiosity is okay at times, but we have to be careful where we let it take us. So here in Jude, we got time. I want to read a little bit more than what I have up on the screen. You know what? Drop all the way back to verse 5. So this is Jude. It's only one chapter. I want to look at this starting at verse 5, because this really helps to make all of these connections. It pulls this together. So verse 5, it says, "But I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterwards destroyed those who did not believe, and the angel who did not keep their proper domain, So the angels that didn't keep their proper domain, the ones that rebelled God. It says, but left their own abode. He has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of that great day. As Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in similar manner to these having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Likewise also these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries. Yet Michael the archangel, when contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. So, quick side note, again, this shows us where we stand. So the position that Satan had, who he was and what he did, it says even Michael, an archangel, still in good graces with God, said he didn't cross a line, which helps us to remember to stay in our lane. To do what we're supposed to do, focus on changing our heart, changing our mind, and being real careful what we say about who. Because it says even Michael didn't talk bad about Satan. All right. And he says, the Lord rebuke you. He left it to God. He goes, this isn't my role. In verse 10, it says, but these speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts. In these things they corrupt themselves. Woe to them. For they have gone in a way of Cain, have run greedily in error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. In verse 12, it says, these are spots in your love feast, while they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves. They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, late autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots. In verse 13, it says, raging waves of sea, foaming up in their own shame, wandering stars, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. That is putting that capstone of everything else we've read. This darkness that is reserved for the demons, for Satan. The blackness of the darkness forever. That's the consequences of the decision that they've made to reject God. Not to be actually tormented, not to be burned up or destroyed. It says they're cast out. They're cast out. That is the penalty that looks like for all of the demons. Now, when we were talking about the goat back in Leviticus, that was specifically talking about Satan and what his penalty was. But it seems like all the demons have that same thing. They're kind of just cast out. They're isolated and alone. They all have the same penalty. Now, I'm not going to spend time on this, but this is a quick view of kind of how all this lays out, of this end time. As from the time that the millennium begins, I'm not going to go over this. I'm going to have to jump through this next section as well. So what this is, I have a bunch of pictures in here from the museum in Pergamos. When we think about Pergamum, if you remember when we went through this seven churches of Revelation, Pergamos was the second one. Revelation chapter 2, we start to talk about Pergamos. The reason that this is important is in there, if you remember, it's been a while, but there's a reference that talks about the throne of Satan. It talks about the throne of Satan being in Pergamum. And that has to do with these are the remnants of that city, of the throne of Zeus. I think that's basically what they called it. Zeus is their primary god. What this is supposed to, that's an aerial view of it. What this is supposed to exemplify is a battle between the spirit god realm and humanity. And this is this battle that takes place. And throughout this, you can actually see several references to why this would be the throne of Satan, why that would be used. We see several snake-like creatures. Some are just snakes. Like this one, you can see this kind of part man, part snake. One of his legs is going into a snake tail. we see a reference to this lion. Last time in part 3, I spent a lot of time going over that section where it talks about Satan walks around like a roaring lion and why that is so important. So in this battle that's supposed to be taking place between these gods and humanity, we also see thrown into this these other two references to who Lucifer is. Snakes and lions in this big battle that ensues. I don't have time to go through all of this with Pergamum and how it plays, but it's interesting. If you ever do some research and look into this, throne of Zeus and what this is, it's really interesting to see why that reference would be made there in Revelation 2. There's another snake head, another one. But this is what this whole kind of picturesque is. What I did want to talk about, though, with the remaining time, is that the saints are given victory over Satan. We win. Surprise! There's no spoiler, right? This is nothing new. It's not hidden. But we win. God has already won. Because His plan is always in place. It's always in place. Head over to Romans chapter 16. Romans chapter 16. As we start to talk about some of these aspects of where we are and how we have already won. Romans chapter 16. Because the first thing I want to talk about is that we've been given power. So the first one isn't actually Romans. The first one I'm just going to reference for you. You can write down Matthew chapter 10 and verse 1. This is at the beginning of when Christ is calling His disciples. And He says here in Matthew chapter 10 verse 1, it says, "And when He had called His 12 disciples to Him, He gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out." He gave them a special ability. The demons can't even do anything to us when we rely on Christ. When we rely on Christ, and we can't do it ourselves, there's no power in us. But when we have the right focus, when we have the right frame of mind, when we are linked with God, when we are living a godly life, He goes, "You have power like you could never imagine." So he allowed them to cast out demons. And it also talks about healing sick. I forget how it says it. I'll go there real quick. Because it wasn't just to cast out demons. He also said, cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of diseases. They were miracle workers. He goes, "This is the power that I'm going to give you. And this is why we don't have to have fear." You know, I've spent all this time going through what Satan's capable of, the power that he does hold over the world right now, that he is the ruler, that he can influence people, but we don't have to be afraid. We shouldn't be afraid because we've already received victory. We've already won. We just have to hold true to the mission. We have to stick to the mission of what God is doing with us. And so now, Romans 16, hopefully you already turned there. Romans 16, if you look at verse 20. It says, "And the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you." He is going to crush Satan. We've spent so much time going over this because I explained that it is important that we know the ins and outs of Satan. Not just that he exists, not that he is just a real being, not that he rejected God, but that we understand that he was created perfectly, and he was corrupted. We've started out on a much worse state. We can be influenced a whole lot easier. That's why we have to dig in our heels, stick to the roots, the core of the Bible, of Scripture, recognize that we are susceptible and do our best not to put ourselves into difficult situations, because we can oftentimes make our job a whole lot harder than it really is because of the decisions that we make, the places that we put ourselves, the people that we surround ourselves with. That all influences how we think, how we eat, how we breathe, the way we process things mentally and emotionally, the things that happen to us physically. All of that is impacted. And then the last reference there, we have to understand his devices. We don't want to be ignorant of them. We went through some of those last time talking about guilt, right? I went through those four. 2 Corinthians 2:11, it says, "Lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices." This is why we're protecting ourselves. This is the barriers that we put into place so that we're not going, "Well, he's not that powerful." Yeah, he is that powerful. He's way more powerful than we give him credit for. Even though it's limited, even though God can stop it at any second, we have to remember he is that powerful. And it's not, I can toe the line, I can get this close, I'll have enough willpower. Because I've been in that spot and I didn't have enough willpower at the end of the day. And then I look back and go, man, I did it again. The next time, I hope that I don't do the, "Well, I have enough willpower." And I go, "Nope, I'm not even going to put myself in that situation." That goes back to that stupidity I talked about earlier, because sometimes I did do the, "Well, I can do it. I know better this time." And then I look back and go, "Nope, didn't know any better." And we have that same battle over and over again. And hopefully the scale is that we continue to get a little bit better and a little bit better. That when we make the bad decision, we don't just drop off and then start back over again. We continue to mature spiritually. And we grow and we develop. So don't be ignorant of what his power really holds, what he's capable of. Now, you don't have to turn to any of these. I'll just reference these as we start to wrap up here. Like, I don't have too many more slides. But we have to actively resist Satan. We have to purposely say, "I don't want that way of life. I don't want to act like that. I don't want that to be part of any of my being. I don't want that." It goes back to, I tell you all the time, until we learn to love God's laws, until we love God's laws, we don't get it. Because we can be Sabbath keepers, we can be holy day keepers, we can do some of the commandments, and we can be just law keepers. We can be law keepers and be really good people as law keepers. But it's once we actually love God's laws that we go, "This is a better way. And I may never be a millionaire because of it, but it is a better way of life." It just naturally is. He goes, "You will have a good life if this is what you live according to." We have to draw closer to the right person and the right people. James 4:7 says, "Therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." Resist the devil and he will flee from you. The next section says, "Draw near to God and he'll draw near to you." That's us being purposeful about actively resisting Satan, his way of life, whatever carrot he dangles in front of us, and going, "No, there's a better path. There's a better choice." You know, I personally believe that Satan gives up on some of us. Normally when we talk about giving up's not a good thing, right? Throwing in the towel's never really a positive thing, but in this case it is. At the point where we reach that we get into our life that Satan is so sure that he's not going to deter us that he moves on. That is a good thing that he gives up on us. Because that means he is so sure that he won't deter us from God's way of life that he goes, "All right, let me go find a different target. Let me go find an easier target." That means that he's taking his attention elsewhere that we've drawn so close to God, that we've resisted Satan so well, that we're doing it right. That's what he says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Now I can't prove that biblically, that Satan will give up on us. But it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? I can make a pretty good argument for it. It makes sense that the point where he goes, there's no chance of deterring this person. No matter what I've thrown at him this far, they've been able to overcome it. I want to be in that spot where he goes, I give up. He gives up on us. Because he's positive that we're ingrained in God's way of life. That we love God's way of life that much more. Back when I was in high school, there was a little church that was between our house and the school. They always put up the funny little sayings and all of their signs. And they had one up there for years. I drove by this all the time. And it stuck with me. I will remember this till the day that I die. It's one of the cheesiest ones there ever was. But it's, if you give Satan an inch, anybody know the rest? If you give Satan an inch, he becomes a ruler. Get it? Yeah. I told you it was cheesy. But I remember it just like it was yesterday. I would chuckle every time I drove past. And they left it up for years, and then eventually they'd change it. And for some reason they'd go back to that one. Somebody must have really liked that one. If you give Satan an inch, he becomes a ruler. And that's this resisting Satan, right? If we give him just a little bit of leeway, that's us toeing that line. I talk about don't even get close to that line. Because as soon as we start getting close to it, that's when we fall. That's when we're like, teetering on the edge, gutter. We don't give him any piece of who we are. And then there's Ephesians 6:11 and Ephesians 4:26 and 27. It's these two. It says, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. God has prepared us. God has given us the equipment that we need. He has given us the instructions that we need to overcome it all. He goes, I have prepared you. He says it may not be easy at times. He goes, but I've given you all the equipment that you need. I've helped you up to the point that I can, and you have to make the choice. And so we have to make our decision. And then chapter 4 in verses 26 to 27 says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. This is a classic one for going to when we talk about anger, that there is a righteous anger. I gave a sermon, may have been a couple years ago now, talking about a godly anger. It was a while ago. I can't hardly remember. But I went through some of these scriptures where it talked about this, that there is a time to be angry and upset, but God clarifies it. And he says, but give no place to the devil. He says, don't open that door. He goes, this can lead to a very bad thing. But he goes, there is a righteous anger. I went through several examples of where God talks about being angry. The anger of the Lord was on the Israelites multiple times. And it's okay for us to be angry. But he says, don't sin. He says, don't take it to that next level and open that door to give place that Satan can go, I gotcha. I gotcha. Because that's what he's waiting for. He's waiting for a little crack in the armor so he can sneak in. This is the last slide that I have. We want to destroy Satan's works. In everything that we do, we know that we've already been given, but we want to destroy his works. This is 1 John chapter 3:8 and then Hebrews 2:14. Now, this word destroy in these two is actually two different words. They're not both the same. 1 John 3:8 it says, he who sins is of the devil. You can turn to Hebrews 2, because Hebrews 2 is the one we're going to look at closer. It says in 1 John 3:8, it says, he who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose, the sons of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. We're trying to rid ourselves of Satan. We're trying to rid each other of Satan. If it was up to us, we'd get Satan out of the world. But right now, God says, focus on yourself. Work on yourself. And then he says, once you've worked so hard on yourself, then you can try to help your brother. Right? Getting the plank out of our own eye before we get the speck out of our brother's eye. He says, work real hard on yourself. He goes, and then you start working on the rest of the family. You help each other. But we're trying to destroy his works. Over here in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14 now. So this word that we're going to look at, it means to render idle, unemployed, inactive, inoperable. To cause the person or the thing to have no further efficiency. Now, this is what we're talking about with Satan and his control right now. This is Hebrews chapter 2, if you look at verse 14. It says, inasmuch then as the children have partaken of the flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. Through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, Satan has already been destroyed. He's already been destroyed. We already have victory, but now we have to fight for it. We have to stick close to that path that leads us down the right spot. And so when we think about this destroyed, Satan, it'd be great for him to be unemployed, inactive. I like to cause a person or a thing to have no further efficiency. I like that one. We want him to have zero efficiency. Normally in every business, if you had zero efficiency, you have no business. Most of the time, if you're like 50% efficiency, you're probably not going to survive as a business. We want Satan to have no efficiency. He honestly has little power. As much as he is the ruler of the world, he really has no power, because he knows it can all be stripped away. In the twinkling of an eye, he's going to be removed. It's going to be done. It's through Jesus Christ's sacrifice, through his shed blood, that we become part of the family of God. Now, our job isn't easy. Our job isn't easy. Life can get very difficult. Whether it's time or chance, or whether it's Satan doing things, health issues, money issues, marriage issues, whatever it may be, there are challenges that happen. But I can guarantee you, the closer we are to God, the easier it is to overcome those things. It won't be easy, easier. Because some of those are really, really hard to swallow. And they're really hard to deal with. And as we get closer to the end time of when Jesus Christ is going to return, Satan's only going to get angrier. He's only going to get more riled up. Because he knows he's got less time. He knows he's got less time, so he's going to do even more work and cause more trouble. We share in this victory when we embody God. When we put on his character. When we have his heart. When we have his mind. We already share in this victory. When we act as one with God the Father and Jesus Christ, we're doing it right. And we have been given victory over Satan. I hope this helps in further understanding who Satan is. Not just that he exists, not that he is a being that fell away from God, but understanding the steps that he went through, why he has ended up where he has gone, and then today of where he's going, what his end result is. Because it's critical in understanding why we have to fight so hard. It is critical. We need to know why we fight so hard, why it's hard for us to resist some of these things, why it's hard to reject him at times. Because he makes things look a whole lot more fun. A whole lot more pleasant. But when we look at this and we look at who Satan is and then who God is, we see that there are very, very clearly two different goals. Two different objectives. Two different paths. As we go through the remaining fundamental beliefs, this is how I plan on going through these. I want to go through these in depth so that you know how to teach this. So that you can defend this. So that you can understand this. This is the whole reason that this is our fundamental beliefs in the United Church of God. Because this is the core of who we are as God's people. The root of what makes us His. Why we actually share in this victory. So I hope this has been advantageous. I hope this can help you to really clearly see that you have already won over God. You just have to make the right choice.